I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is a sort of Brown University instant seminar, way jumping the 100 days gun to get our bearings in Obama time in the first 10 days of it. In this first round, two young stars of the Brown faculty, Corey Walker in Africana Studies, who looks especially at religious belief and political ideology and their mixtures in cultures around the world, and James Dedarian, who's a strategic and cultural analyst of war and media and their intersections in a digitized era of global networks. Before you go deep, Corey and James, I'd love you to locate your thinking with three quick comments, please. Your brightest hope, your gravest fear, and a word of advice to the president or maybe to us as we start this Obama course. Corey, a hope, a fear, a word.
Thanks, Chris. I'm glad to be here with you. I'm glad to be here with James. My greatest hope is that the American people will continue their high level of energy around politics, that it will not dissipate because the election and the inauguration is over, but it will just increase as time progresses. My greatest fear really is that instead of seizing and catalyzing that hope for change, true change, fundamental transformative change of American empire, that we have empire by another name, empire as leadership. My suggestions or advice for the future is directed to my colleagues, people around the world. Continue clinging to hope. And as Langston Hughes always said, hold fast to dreams. For when dreams die, life becomes a broken-winged bird that cannot fly. Dreams continue to live. They continue to be fulfilled. And the work before us is a lot and arduous, and we are up for the task.
James Dedarian.
Greatest hope that the Obama moment lasts longer than a nanosecond. I hope that not 7 days out, but 8 years out, that we'll come back and be on the Chris Lydon Radio Open Source Show, and we'll be talking about not the Obama moment, but the Obama age. And I don't want to put this all on his shoulders, but it's all about making the moment a long now. We're long past, I think, the idea of an age, the American age, the American century. It's 24/7, and that is my fear, is that because of the rapidity of news cycles, that we're not going to give this guy a chance. Advice to him, it might seem sort of paradoxical, but I would say hang on to the BlackBerry. Don't let it out of your cold, dying hands. I mean, Obama as candidate, Obama as president, I think he gets it. He gets the importance of interconnectivity. We're living in an incredibly complex, interconnected world. Getting outside that bubble, the Washington bubble, through technology is going to be so important, I think, for him keeping contact with dissident viewpoints and something close to mass politics as opposed to beltway politics.
James, you can stretch out on this if you like. What is the moment about? This amazing simultaneity of dire anxiety with a sense that we haven't seen the bottom at all of the economy or maybe the political crisis, and this euphoria about this beautiful young man leading the world.
I think it has to do with empire and the way Corey spoke of, but also what Edmund Burke called the empire of circumstance. In some ways, that trumps all other imperial intentions. The now means that you have to deal with not one crisis, not two, but sometimes, you know, five in simultaneity because of the speed of representation, the acceleration of everything. And I think Obama's strength is that he's quite adept and he's at ease with the now. He's in some ways like, you know, the great jazz musicians who understand you have to lay down the structure underneath, but you've got to be able to improv with a coolness.
I was just going to say, you remind me of what Bono wrote in the New York Times the other day about Sinatra. He said, it's about the now. What does that mean? What did Sinatra mean? What did Bono mean? How does Obama use it?
The resemblance is uncanny between the chairman and the president. I think the pragmatism that he extols is about the now. It's being able to be practical but still hang on to principles.
You seem to be advising us not to expect a restoration or a return to a kind of normal heartbeat, but get used to this kind of frenetic digital speed of absolutely everything.
Well, we've seen 8 years of trying to securitize America in a way that's impossible. I mean, the borders are permeable. The threats are real. But by the very means by which we try to protect ourselves from them, we create worst, I think, terrors, worst fears. And it's almost like an autoimmune response, that the response to the disease is worse than the disease itself. Obama gets that. I think that he understands, like the rest of the world, Americans have to learn to live with some of this contingency. One of the reasons I think we pretended or wanted to be an imperial power, we did not really have the means to do so, is because of this radical contingency of globalization.
What does that mean?
Well, it means that, you know, the terror of not having food on your table, you know, in the next 24 hours is a form of terror for a big chunk of the world. Not being able to have access to, you know, America's idol, whatever, is not a terrorizing event. It should not be. And yet we become so, I think, inured to how the rest of the world responds to contingency that we want to have some sort of absolute form of it, and it comes at a cost. It's a zero-sum game.
Corey, before we're done, I hope you will locate whatever the underlying system of belief is that was animated on Inauguration Day. But let me just start by noting, for me anyway, that it was an unusually churchy moment in public life. I'd like a tough-minded answer to a sort of tender-hearted question. What is the chance that Martin Luther King's thinking kind of came to blossom in that inauguration, not about skin color, not about civil rights, but specifically about a different public morality, the morality that we hear in the black church, which is scriptural but not literal. It is of a special people in history, but it is not tribal. It is so many subtle combinations that were threaded into that moment. It is expressive. At the same time, it's a deeply reflective, et cetera. I wondered, can this be a kind of glimmer of the blessed community that Martin Luther King Jr. spoke about? Is that too much?
A tough-minded answer?
Yeah.
The inauguration did not represent the end of history. What I mean by that is simply this. It was a political event.
Okay.
It's a political event that we mark every 4 years in American political life. And as political event, we understand that it has to invoke a certain aura of the sacred, because the nation always invokes the divine. To telescope King to this moment in 2008 is actually not to talk about it as a political event, but actually to make it the end of history. Mm. That this becomes the culminating point of all that we've set out to do. It creates this nice linear line from 1776 to 2008. And it actually legitimates all of the wrongs of the nation, because in a sense it says we need those wrongs in order to achieve this moment. We needed slavery in order that we would have black people. We needed the genocide of Native Americans so that we could then import Africans as slaves. We needed the Civil War just so we can have a marginal African American presence. We needed the assassination of King so that we could
and
have...
And Bobby Kennedy, maybe.
And Kennedy, so that we could have an Obama. I don't think so, Chris. Hmm. It was a political event. It was a political event that had to invoke not just a political sensibility about America, but the divine moment that is God bless America. It had to invoke those theological undertones that animate every national enterprise. And that's what we saw on Inauguration Day. The beauty of the nation is never purely a political project. It is never about just space and time in human terms, but it is always about time immemorial. It is about eternity.
James, theology is not in your brief, James, but do you want to comment on that theological thread from Rick Warren to Joseph Lowery?
I think you call that a leading question. Yes, I have remarked that it was nice to be in the big tent that Obama constructed during his inaugural talk, where he talked not only about Jews and Christians and Muslims and Hindus, but also non-believers. And I don't believe that there is a, you know, divine being, one single divine being that's watching over us and making sure that the American history ends with this grace note that Corey speaks of. As an agnostic, I welcome this opportunity to be included in this big tent. But also, I think that Corey's hit on something that's very important, and that is the extent to which not just the United States, but any great power, and particularly those with imperial intentions, exercise political theologies. We like to believe that we're entering this sort of desacralized space of politics, but politics is always already faith-based. Carl Schmitt wrote about this in the interlude between the Weimar Republic and the rise of Nazi Germany. So Obama is going to be influenced by the nature of the state, and there'll be pressure to exercise the exception if there is another attack on American soil. Can he somehow or another resist this? And this determination, which Schmitt calls of whose friend, whose foe, which is the sovereign exception recurrently in the history of great powers, does Obama have it to somehow or another cast a new form, perhaps a less rigid form of sovereignty that relies more on the community of states as opposed to the exceptional state?
You're both talking about empire as an underlying thread in all of our lives today. Where did you feel on Inauguration Day kind of evidences of this empire question?
The question of empire came up not so much as empire in the language that we've known for the past 8 years, not so much as we will demonstrate to the world our resolve and America will be second to no nation. Instead, it morphed itself into the language of American leadership. America will once again provide leadership for the world. The last I've heard, last I talked to people across the globe, they don't want America to lead. I mean, American leadership has been notoriously bad globally. We've also heard it exercised in terms, articulated rather in the inaugural address when President Obama said, we will not apologize for our way of life. These stand in direct contradictions to the desire to create a dialogue among nations, to create a much more a communal, a community of nations. Instead, we see that empire will now have a velvet glove, if you will, that America retains its right to exercise its sovereignty and in ways in which that may pierce the sovereignty of other nations. I love the way Hillary Clinton put it. She said it'll be a smart mix of economic, diplomatic, and military pressures to continue the American project. And that is actually deleterious to any sort of conversation amongst nations as equals.
What did he mean by that line about our way of life? He didn't exactly mean that as 5% of the world population, we're going to continue to account for 25% of the global pollution, did he? Or what was that about?
I don't think he was exalting in the American way of life. He's just saying, I'm not going to apologize for it if you are an enemy of it. That was my context. Corey and I might have some distance on this question. Yeah. I would perhaps push Corey a bit further because I'm not sure if there is a possibility of imperialism given the outcome of this debacle in Iraq, not because of the election, just because of the last 8 years, because of globalization, because there is no possibility of unipolarity. I think the unipolar moment disappeared somewhere in Fallujah, when it was demonstrated that overwhelming military power and economic power could not defeat an insurgency. I've used the term heteropolarity. I think there's a lot
meaning.
Of...
Uh,
heteropolarity in the sense that there are many other actors now on the playing field in that the world order no longer can be determined by a few great powers. The world order now is a disorder because there is a super empowered individual in a cave somewhere on the border between Pakistan and Afghanistan that can use the media and interconnectivity to force multiply his force through what? Terror, fear, yes, but also there is another belief system operating there. A belief system that might be alien to our own, but yet still can secure enough suicide bombers to make the playing field level.
Corey, you make it sound as if he's simply put a velvet glove on the old imperial fist, and yet on his seventh day in office, he made a remarkable opening to the world, or to the Islamic world specifically, in which he said America was not born as a colonial power. As if to acknowledge that it's not all ours, but that we haven't exactly made a picnic out of our imperial moment. And he said to Islam, especially, America is not your enemy. There's a readiness, I think, a readiness to see things in context, including the Arab-Israeli thing in a larger sweep of history and geography, and to deal with it much more comprehensively. Are you discounting that or not?
I mean, America wasn't born a colonial power. I wonder what the First Nations would have to say about that. I would wonder, you know, what Cuba would have to say about that. I would wonder what Haiti would have to say about that. The ways in which we've exercised colonial power in and throughout the Western Hemisphere.
No question we've done it. But I think he's simply saying, he's reminding us that we were born in revolution against an empire and that that's still part of our sense of ourselves.
Who was living in America at the time of our colonization of the Americas?
True.
America not being born a colonial power. So historically, that has some extreme problematics as to who counts and who doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to begin with a quote from John Bellamy Foster. Imperialism isn't a policy. It's a systematic reality.
Hmm.
When we say that we have empire with a velvet glove, just because we have an election doesn't mean the systematic reality changes. Imperialism or empire, as William Appleton Williams reminds us, empire as a way of life, deals with the ways in which we have the distribution of goods and services that still cohere within a centralized power structure. This is where I would, James and I will have a good conversation on this. When we look at just what happened in the past 7 days when President Obama okayed the latest strikes in Iraq, in Afghanistan, we had 22 civilians killed. That's when imperialism as a way of life becomes real. We may not see this, we may not see the escalation in the Iraqi theater, but we're going to see an escalation in the Afghan theater. We're going to continue to see escalations on the Horn of Africa, military escalations. The one thing that I love, while we're closing Guantanamo, I'd love to see what we're going to do with the Air Force Base Bagram in Afghanistan, but I also would love to know what we're going to do with Djibouti. I'd also love to know what we're going to do with prisons all around the world to which we ship and rendition, our policy of rendition. How will that change? So I think the jury's still out. I mean, we've had an election. And I think this is what the real critical question is. After elections, where does politics enter?
Mm.
I mean, what's the space of politics now? Not just inside the Beltway, but what happens when individuals get upset, not because we're going to bomb Afghanistan, but because we love to have terrorist interdictions in the drug trade in Latin and South America.
Mm-hmm.
When we see drug interdiction under the guise of security. So we have terrorism now. Drug dealers are terrorists. So we're not only looking at interdiction in Latin and South America, but also the Caribbean. But this hasn't come up for conversation because we feel good now. And Obama makes us feel good.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, I want us to begin to, if we want to invoke king, let's invoke a king that becomes inconvenient, one who constantly preaches against the triple evils of militarism, economic exploitation and racism. That doesn't coincide with the project of empire. And that's why you can't, that's why we can't telescope King to Obama.
It's still puzzling to me how deeply dedicated the popular will in this country is to empire. Maybe we're going to find out. But let me put it in this term to you, James Dudarian. If worse economic times, serious unemployment, and all the anger that comes with it still lies ahead, and if in times of crisis nations come to fundamental identities, where will the popular will in the country take us? And what does Barack Obama's election and his presidency have to do with it?
Well, this isn't a question with an abstract answer. It's happening now. It's happening on the periphery of our concerns, our media attention. I mean, there's been riots and in Hungary, in Latvia, in Romania, in many of these, you know, formerly captive nations that bought into the myth of, you know, instant success, instant riches, and now those expectations are dashed because of the global downturn. For the first time, you know, tear gas is being used against these populations. And again, not registering a big blip because we're still in this sort of exaltation of our own, you know, successful elections. And I do want to take care here. I don't want to, like, basically rain on the Obama parade. But in some ways, it's our obligation. I think we're both sort of as sort of, to the extent we're publicly now playing the role of critical intellectuals, we're supposed to ask these questions. It's sort of our obligation to ask these questions. So I can simultaneously exalt in the incredible celebration of this man's victory and with Corey, however, say, let's beware, though, that this is not a panacea. This is a struggle, and it's going to be a long struggle given the particular historical forces at work right now.
This moment of belief we're in cannot does not register within the smooth languages and nice, refined cultures of what we think of as politics proper. It has the ability to actually explode in any moment, and we can't account for it. And that becomes the real interesting issue. How do we respond to the very explosion that's really possible that we do see under the surface?
What does it tell us that in this moment of belief, our faith is so heavily invested in a man at a time when our faith in institutions, including the auto industry or the banks or the military, is so low? We put an awful lot on one shining guy.
Well, I'm going to quote someone I know who's dear to your heart, Chris, Ralph Waldo Emerson, who said that institutions are the lengthened shadows of individuals. And the sort of literal interpretation is this, that, you know, it's the person that counts as great man history. But Emerson, I think, was a little more sophisticated than that. He recognizes that we all have shadow selves. We have, like, the dark sides. And anybody who wants to be president of the United States, in my mind, must have a dark side. It comes with the ambition, the drive, and everything. And the dark side is you start to believe your own rhetoric. For the most part, I think it's the rhetoric, I think, of, you know, virtue and hope. He mentions that, you know, several times in the course of his inaugural and elsewhere. But we've seen what happens when virtue becomes righteous or self-righteous with, you know, the past 8 years. And what happens if hope rises expectations so high that you could never possibly meet them given the realities of historical, you know, conditions at this moment. So it's tempering hope and virtue. I guess also it's recognizing that this man has an aura, okay? And the aura is very powerful. And yet something we learned from Walter Benjamin, every time I come on your show, I have to quote Walter Benjamin at least once.
Go
too.
For it.
That, you know, with the ability to technically reproduce anything and everything with simultaneity and instantaneity, that aura is in some ways corrupted or altered. And for me, the iconic moment of the last 7 days is when they took that image that we are so familiar with now, that where Obama morphed as sort of Malcolm X and Che with the multiple colors, the street art.
Ship Ferry poster.
Exactly. It's just hung in the Smithsonian. Now, I'm all for street art getting into those, you know, hallowed halls of the Smithsonian. But the question is, what happens when we become more identifying with the aura rather than with the man, who's obviously going to have fallibilities, is going to have, you know, make some mistakes? What happens then if we still want to believe only in the aura and not the actual reality?
Corey Walker, what happens?
I'll give you two takes. One take is, I think we're in a moment where the politics of personality have now become absolutely triumphant. And it becomes the, and we're in a moment now where the actual operations of politics, the fine-tune operations, the language of policy, the discourse of diplomacy, questions around economic policy fade into the background. And the more important question becomes, do I like this person? Is he handsome? Or in the case with Bush, do I want to have a beer with the person? We may be in a moment where personality trumps politics. Optimistically, we can be in a birth of a new form of humanism, what I would like to call a form of democratic humanism, where we can see possibility in those formerly marginalized groups for a renewal of civic life and public culture that at one time did not, could not exist, or existed only in very marginal and small ways. Hopefully we'll see the expansion of this possibility of democratic humanism, not only within the U.S., but also globally. And it will morph and expand not just in the politics of symbols, but also in the politics of substance, so that we can have what James talked about, a community of nations. Hopefully this democratic humanism can be a rebirth of a sort of a wider, more planetary humanism that speaks of the beloved community that you talked about earlier with King.
What can I say but amen? And thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Sarah Archambault and Paul McCarthy produced and edited this conversation. Listeners, feedback at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thanks for joining the conversation.